Good morning, everyone. It is February 13th. I hope everybody's prepared for Valentine's Day tomorrow. This is your warning, if it's fallen off your radar, to do something about that. I will call the meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. And the first item of business is, we do have a quorum present. I need to state that on the record. And I'm wondering if Representative Mahmoud would like to move the minutes from 2 days ago, from the February 11th. Turn your mic.
Madam Chair.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you. The minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor approving the minutes of February 11th, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. The first bill we have for consideration in our committee this morning is House File 20, and I will move that bill. I will move that House File 20 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. And so if the bill's author would come to the testifiers table, and the three testifiers we have on the docket are James Dickey, Don Gimberling, and Rich Neumeister. And so we will hear from them eventually, but Representative Niska, or Majority Leader Niska, thank you for joining us this morning. Welcome to the committee. You used to be part of this committee, so welcome back. And go ahead with your testimony. House File 20 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the warm welcome back to Judiciary. It still is the best committee. So I'm happy to be back here, and I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 20. It's a very, very small change in our statute books, but it's a very important bill. It just adds two words to Section 13.65, but it accomplishes three very important goals. The first is to correct what I believe is a statutory interpretation error that was made by the Minnesota Supreme Court in a split 4-3 decision with Justice Thiessen, former Speaker Thiessen, writing the principal dissent. The Minnesota Supreme Court interpreted a provision about data on individuals to include data that doesn't have to do with any individual. It distorted the meaning of the Data Practices Act in important ways, and we should correct that statutory interpretation error. We have conversations between the legislative branch and judicial branch, and that's an important part of our role as the legislative branch to respond when the judicial branch interprets the statutes that we write incorrectly. Second, it restores a balanced approach to the Data Practices Act. The Data Practices Act puts a premium on government transparency, but also protects the privacy of individual people, and that's why there are protections for data on individuals defined as natural persons. This misinterpretation in Energy Policy Advocates versus Ellison flips that on its head and takes away government transparency even when there is no interest in any individual privacy present. But the third and most important reason is that it enhances the goal of transparency and accountability in this very important office. There are a lot of interest groups that are trying to influence attorney general's offices all across the country, and this is happening from the right and from the left. Nonprofits, corporations, law firms, dark money funds are all trying to influence attorney general's offices, sometimes even funding attorneys within those offices to achieve certain policy goals. And it's important that at least we, the people of the state of Minnesota, have the ability to see what is going on. And unfortunately, the current interpretation of the Data Practices Act shields a lot of that from public view. The public needs to know who is able to influence the attorney general's office and how. And so we need to correct this interpretation of the Data Practices Act in order to do that, and that's what House File 20 helps to do. It just adds two words that were suggested by Justice Thiessen in his dissent in Energy Policy Advocates versus Ellison, and that's why I'm bringing this bill forward today, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it.
Thank you, Majority Leader Niska. So would you... Is Mr. Dickey your first witness that you, or first testifier you'd like to bring forward?
Certainly. Don Gimberling, I believe, is here to testify.
Okay. Mr. Gimberling, if you want to come to the table and introduce yourself for the record. and then go ahead with your testimony. And I just want to give a little background on Mr. Gimberling. He'll probably give you some anyway, but especially for the freshmen on the committee. Mr. Gimberling helped write the Minnesota Data Practices Act and served in the Department of Administration in that realm for, I don't know, he's going to tell us how long, but it was a long time. And he speaks, when he speaks on this subject, he speaks with authority. So thank you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Representative Scott indicated, my name is Don Gimberling. I've been doing this for a long time. When I retired from state government, I took up a role as a citizen advocate on these kinds of issues. I spent 29 years working on that when I worked for the Department of Administration. Today, I'm representing the Minnesotans for Open Government. We changed our name recently from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We got some public feedback that said the former name didn't have a lot of pizzazz. So that's why I'm here, that's who I'm representing. And you also have written testimony from Matt Ealing, who's another member of the board of the Minnesotans for Open Government. And it's pretty extensive, and what I'm kind of do is kind of pull together what Matt has given you in great detail. So I'm gonna do two things, I hope, today. I'm going to tell you how we got here. Part of my role is kind of the resident historian of the Data Practices Act, and why Representative Niska's bill is important and important to enact. So some history quickly. Beginning in 1974 with a discussion about data privacy, which is really on my mind recently because of what's happening in Washington, the legislature decided it should take on the issue of data privacy, okay? In doing so, and in the enactments they did after that, they were always very careful to treat data on individuals, i.e. people, differently than data on institutions. And an undercurrent to that was data not on people tended to get a lot less protection in the statute, including fewer rights than data on people. In 1979, after some serious lobbying, mostly by the media community in Minnesota, the legislature took on the issue of what we had as an ancient open records law, public records law. And what they did to get a transition going is they stated in 79 that all government data, which in the Data Practices Act has a very broad definition, would be public, effective a year following. Part of the process was to encourage people to go to the Department of Administration and asked for what was then called emergency classifications of data, which then the department, in summary, would submit to the legislature in the following session. Okay, so in doing so, the legislature also created a data classification system, in which data on people had certain classifications: private, confidential, and public. And data not on people had similar classifications, just different terminology: public, non-public, and protected non-public. And so agencies across the state, including local government, were asked to submit applications to the Department of Administration to determine that certain data in their hands would be not public within those categories. So in functioning in this world of emergency classifications, the Department of Administration literally got hundreds of applications, okay? My job was to supervise their processing and make recommendations to the commissioner, okay? And when I say hundreds, Hennepin County sent us a banker's box full of applications, okay? And so people responded to what you said, which was everything's going to be public unless you get some other classification. So this is how Section 13.65, which is the subject of Representative Niska's bill, came into existence. One of the agencies that submitted an application for emergency classification was the Attorney General's office. And their application pretty much said what's in Section 13.65, with one critical difference. They asked the commissioner to approve all of the data described in that section as not public. And so then the commissioner wasn't willing to do that, okay? So we entered into a negotiation with the Attorney General's office, and what resulted from that was an application that was approved that said all data on individuals, as described in Section 13.65, would be private, okay? Thereby leaving out data not on individuals. So after that, after things were real quiet about this particular section of the Data Practices Act, literally for years, okay? One of the things I did in state government was, among other things, be the person that state agencies would call when they had issues. And so that's what I'm telling you about things were quiet is based on that experience. And then in 1974, after the big settlement was reached with the tobacco companies, and one of the more interesting people I ever dealt with, a guy named Archie Anderson, if you want a stereotypical Minnesota name, came to my office and said, I'm trying to get data out of the AG's office and they won't give it to me. Okay? So we talked about what data he was asking for, and essentially he was trying to find out what the AG's office was doing with some of the settlement money. So at that time, citizens, agencies, were able to go to the Commissioner of Administration and ask for a commissioner's opinion. That was something that was put into the statute in the early 90s, in part to help agencies do a better job of complying, and also to give citizens a little boost up when they dealt with the government. So Mr. Anderson asked us for an opinion as to whether or not what the Attorney General was doing was correct. And the Attorney General submitted a response. The commissioner looked at the issue and decided that all of the information Mr. Anderson was asking for was data not on individuals. And therefore, the classification of private in Section 1365 did not apply. So after that, the Attorney General, not surprisingly, came to the legislature and said, I don't like this result, which the AG had every right to do. And so there was a discussion in the predecessor to this committee in the House as to whether or not they would approve an amendment to the Data Practices Act, essentially saying all of the data in that section would be not public. And the House did not agree to do that amendment, and as of 1995, actually, that was kind of the end of the discussion until we get to the case that the Supreme Court decided a couple of years ago and the Energy Policy Advocates case. And in looking at the case, they essentially, what the Supreme Court did was to say that they rejected a long-standing interpretation of Section 13.65, okay? They also, and here's the problem that some of us are really troubled by, they essentially took this very elaborate classification system and they did this to it, they skewed it. As opposed to saying if you have data on people, it's always over here, and data not on people, it's always over here, the Supreme Court said we can do this to it, essentially. And that's not how anything ever worked, okay? Part of the presentations that I made to government agencies, and I made hundreds of them, always pretty much started the same place. In those days, it was an overhead that said this is the data classification system, because the data classification system in the Data Practices Act is what determines what people's rights are and what government has to do when it has government data. So, now, moving on, it's important in this discussion to understand that our Attorney General plays at least two dual roles as part of the government in Minnesota. He is both the state's chief legal officer and law enforcement officer, but he's also the administrative head of one of the state's most powerful constitutional officers. As chief legal officer, much of the data that the Attorney General's office has is already protected by a number of sections in the Data Practices Act in addition to Section 13.65. For example, Section 1339, the civil investigative data section, covers the Attorney General's office as it does all public attorneys. Section 13.393 which is the attorney work product provision of the Data Practices Act, which was suggested to the legislature by the Attorney General, also covers the Attorney General's office, as it does all public attorneys. Lastly, Section 13.82, to the extent that the Attorney General gets involved in criminal investigations, data in an active investigation is protected by that section, okay? So he has, in essence, because of the interpretation by the Supreme Court, more protection for the government data in his hands than any agency in the state of Minnesota, including the governor's office, okay? And that's part of the problem with this. Now, one thing I didn't say about Minkoji, or Mog, I'm sorry, I'll get adjusted to it. We are extraordinarily nonpartisan in what we do, okay? Frankly, when I worked for the state of Minnesota, I came from the old civil service tradition and tried my best to always be nonpartisan, which usually worked, okay? So it troubles us then that with the Attorney General's function, not as the chief legal officer, but as an administrative officer of an important state government function, that he gets more protection than anybody else. I'll give you an example. If you look at Section 13.65, you'll see that part of what is now protected in the Attorney General's office is all communications and non-investigative files regarding administrative or policy matters which do not evidence final public actions. Which I interpret it, and keep in mind, administrative and policy matters is not defined anywhere in this section. That essentially, if you want to take a broad interpretation, covers everything the Attorney General's office does, okay? And that's going to be the case whether or not we have a DFL Attorney General or we have a Republican Attorney General. And I frankly don't think you want the Attorney General to keep secret virtually everything he or she does, okay? And that's a policy decision you're going to have to make. So it does protect all of the Attorney General's data, essentially, based on what the Supreme Court did in its interpretation. So, now, part of what the Attorney General's office sent a letter to you, and I've seen this letter before in the Senate. Part of what they said, the other thing that I get stuck on is I majored in history, which another small liberal arts college person like Representative Niska knows is one of those useless majors because you got to do something else with it. But I really care about history, okay? And one of the things the Attorney General said in their letter was that Section 13.65 reflects a careful balancing of competing interests. Or competing goals. I'm sorry about that. I have to tell you that the legislature, except for the one time in 1995, after the commissioner's opinion, you've never discussed this section, okay? So I don't know where this careful balancing is coming from. I suppose you could say the negotiation between me and the Department of Administration and an Attorney General staff member back in 1979 represented a careful balancing, but essentially we were just trying to reach some kind of compromise so that things could go forward. So, Representative Niska's bill would correct that problem, hopefully, okay? One of the things I am also, and again, the history bias, I'm a real Orwellian, and part of the reason I love Justice Thiessen's opinion was he commented on how Orwellian the majority decision was to take a clearly defined term and rewrite that term based on essentially no reality whatsoever. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Gamberling, for your testimony and kind of the history of this area of statute. That's, I think, really insightful as we consider this bill. So we will reserve questions until after all the testifiers have gone. Representative Niska, who is your next testifier?
Thank you. James Dickey, the attorney who represented energy policy advocates in that Minnesota Supreme Court case, is here to testify as well.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Dickey. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Scott, honorable members of this committee. I'm James Dickey. I'm here to testify on this bill in my personal capacity, not on behalf of any organization, to be clear. In January of 2022, as Chair Scott and Representative Niska pointed out, I argued the case Energy Policy Advocates versus Ellison to the Minnesota Supreme Court on behalf of the respondent in that case, Energy Policy Advocates. And I know that my my colleague and friend from the Attorney General's office, who was the opposite side of the case, is here as well today. I'm testifying to provide the committee context related to the Supreme Court's decision in that case, developments since then, and why the committee should support the bill to amend Section 1365 to clarify the data in this section protects its data on individuals, not on data without individual subjects, such as discussion of public policy matters and AG investigative data that are not on individuals. Energy Policy Advocates brought its data lawsuit against the Attorney General because it was denied access to documents related to the Attorney General's practice of allowing the New York University State Energy and Environment Impact Center to place Special Assistant Attorneys General in the AG's office for purpose of bringing environmental lawsuits, such as the state's lawsuit against energy producers on a legal theory that has now been rejected by state courts in New Jersey, New York, and Maryland. NYU pays these attorneys, not the state, which may violate state law. Energy Policy Advocates argued that the withheld responsive data, which was not on individuals, should have been released to them because it's not protected by Section 1365. The Supreme Court's decision changed the traditional interpretation of the DPA, as Mr. Gemmerling just gave you an exhaustive history of, such that the data described by Section 1365 Subdivision 1 are now only accessible to an individual if there is an individual who is the subject of the data. In other words, if data held by the Attorney General and within the categories of Section 1365 do not have any individual as a subject, then the data are not accessible to anyone else. And as Matt Ealing of the renamed MNCOGI, M-O-G, as I just heard, correctly stated in his written testimony, the approach the majority in Energy Policy Advocates took is confusing and it defies plain language. It's also inconsistent with this time-honored understanding of how the Data Practices Act classification system works. I think Justice Thiessen's dissent succinctly summarized how data is classified under the DPA, and properly so. And so the Attorney General's, I would also want to note that since then we've seen in litigation, the Attorney General's office does not really believe what the majority in the Energy Policy Advocates case said about the meaning of data on individuals. The AG also believes, as we said in that case, that data on individuals only refers to data about individuals as subjects. And I point the committee to Jensen versus Ellison, where the Attorney General argued in the Carver County District Court that data retrieved based on searching for Scott Jensen's name is not data on individuals to which he was entitled under Section 13.65 because, quote, the subjects of such data are the complainants and the entities, persons, or matters complained about. Plaintiff would have the court believe these are documents about him and that he is therefore entitled to access their contents, but he is not the subject of these data. And that is attached to an excerpt from that memorandum of law is attached to my written testimony submitted to this committee. The meaning of data on individuals, I would submit then, is clear to everyone. And declaring that data not on individuals should be treated as data on individuals simply doesn't make sense. So the court's Energy Policy Advocates decision is a problem because it shields from the public important, number one, policy, and number two, investigative data from the public eye. That strips the public of the ability to evaluate the AG's public serving operations and understanding what policy and investigation decisions it has made on controversial public matters. And as to the definition of policy matters in Subdivision 1B, the Minnesota Supreme Court has not opined on it. Mr. Gemmerling just pointed out that there isn't a clear statement. I think that the emergency classification document from the 70s that Mr. Gemmerling referenced, I think it was Assistant Attorney General Byron Starnes who made the request, I think it categorized or characterized policy as related to internal policies and administrative type policies, but there's not a clear statement from this legislature or from the courts as to what that is. And I think that this committee, honorable committee, made up of legislators who deal with policy in their work can understand how broadly the term policy matters could be interpreted by a court if had the opportunity to do so. And I think that seizing on the Energy Policy Advocates' decision on investigative data, the AG is now also on record as arguing that all investigative data, material in its possession, whether active or inactive, and again, Mr. Gemmeling referenced 13.39, which deals with active versus inactive data. Their view is that it overrides 13.39, and it's all protected from disclosure, whether active or inactive. And the AG made this point explicitly in data litigation in Stinson LLP versus Ellison, number 62 CV 21-2112, in a memorandum written to Judge Patrick Diamond discussing the Energy Policy Advocates decision, which is also attached to my written testimony. Given the breadth of current federal and state investigations into the rampant fraud that has pervaded Minnesota in the last 6 years, that is a massive problem. And finally, I think it's important to consider that whatever the commission or the committee or the legislature does with this bill will have repercussions that affect the Attorney General's office, regardless of whether a Democrat or a Republican is in that office. Given how close the 2022 race was for the office, I'm sure we all recognize that who fills that office can easily change in future elections. The data that the Attorney General believes should not be produced under this subdivision simply is important for Minnesotans to know. It is important for Minnesotans to know that outside special interests are funding specific types of litigation using the powers of the Attorney General's office and how that relationship works. It's important for Minnesotans to know how their AG is collaborating with other state AGs. And consider a different hypothetical. What if a Republican were to win the AG race in 2026 and then decide to make an arrangement just like the AG's arrangement with NYU, but with America First Legal, the law firm whose founder is the Trump White House senior advisor, Stephen Miller, a known supporter of enforcing this nation's immigration laws? And then let's say that instead of funding lawsuits against energy companies, that sort of public interest law firm pays the salaries of a special assistant attorney general to work with the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Minnesota to prioritize deportation of non-citizens illegally in the United States and Minnesota. Should the Attorney General's office be allowed to refuse to turn over data comprising the details of that relationship or how the office is coordinating or collaborating with other state attorneys general? The effect of the Supreme Court's Energy Policy Advocates decision may have that effect unless it's corrected by this bill. The people of Minnesota deserve to know that kind of information should that kind of thing arise. And so the Energy Policy Advocates majority's decision cries out for legislative correction. The authors of this bill have chosen the manner the Supreme Court itself called out for appropriately changing the law's meaning back to the traditional meaning that you just heard testified about. And at bottom, this change would shed more sunlight on the Attorney General's actions, where the privacy interests of individuals and other confidentiality restrictions are not imposed by statute. Important public affecting Attorney General data should be available for public review and consideration. And that coheres with the central premise of the Data Practices Act. All government data is presumed public unless otherwise classified by this legislature. So I thank the committee for its time. And again, I'd urge the committee to support the proposed bill. I would be happy to take any questions or just yield until later.
Mr. Dickey, thank you. Please be on standby. I'm guessing members may have questions eventually here. So Representative Niska, who's your next testifier?
Thank you, Chair Scott. Those were the two testifiers that I'm aware of. There may be some others who are here interested in testifying as well.
Okay, thank you. I know Mr. Neumeister is has contacted our committee and would like to testify. And I want to bring members' attention to a packet in our folders this morning from Matt Ealing with Minnesotans for Open Government. He has a lot of documentation in there, including the commission's opinion back in 1974, 94, one of those, right, on this specific issue. And then also he has Justice Thiessen's opinion in there as well. And on page 19 of Judge Thiessen's opinion is that table that kind of shows the different classifications of data on individuals versus not on individuals. And so to the extent that that helps educate committee members, I think that is a really helpful table. Mr. Neumeister, please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Rich Neumeister. My testimony today is just like I've always done. This is for me. I work with everybody. I just come from an angle of sunshine and good government accountability. As you know, my testimony is very detailed in terms of written testimony. I don't intend to get into that. I intend to give you what my experience has been, to highlight some what's in the record, and then to respond to the Attorney General's letter. I have worked with five Attorney Generals, with Warren Spanis through Keith Ellison. I've asked numerous times over those years for information that I was able to get from inactive investigative files and dealing with policy matters, because they were public, they weren't dealing with individuals. And a lot of that information helped me with legislation before the legislature historically. I also want to point out on the public record of that was submitted by Matt Elling. If you look on page 3 of that record, you'll see that there was an asking for an opinion because someone was interested to ask for a communication between task forces that the Attorney General was being involved in with at that time. And I think that was an opinion, I think it was in 2000, whatever, but if you look, it'll give you the date. The Attorney General said, well, we don't have that information, but if we did have it, we would give it to you because they consider it public. With now the court interpretation, that is no longer public. If you take a look on page 14 of the document that Mr. Elling submitted, you'll see public records media was asking some questions about how charities and the dynamics and how do you decide how a charity or charitable organization could be recognized. And there was some discussion, I want to know how you do that. You know, how does the AG do that? And in that letter, which was from just last year, 2023, stated, well, it's not public. And then if you also go on, because public records media was doing some more interaction with the AG, and the party, public records media, knew that the data was confidential during the investigation, and in the communication said, hey, well, when it's when inactive, which has been public for 40 years, not on individuals, hey, I'll look at it when you finish your investigation. And if you look on that letter, you'll see it's very emphasized. You're not going to be able to get it because of the EPA decision. I have spoken with reporters who have gotten information from inactive investigations. And one of those reporters shared with me about a criminal investigation of incident involving Joseph Jevrett Washington. It was an item that was done August 5th, 2021. It was involved with an officer-involved shooting. That person got that memoranda. It was basically a memoranda of the investigation. Again, the AG does not do a lot of criminal investigations, but they do some. This was a document, a memo of why they weren't charging an officer. Well, that memo, more than likely, under this interpretation, will no longer be public. Again, it was just some perspectives I think that's important to be aware, and I've tried to point out. Even in the 7 or 8 situations over 40 years in my interaction with the AG, I was able to get the kind of data that I asked for. I can share with you in detail what that was. It's up to you, but I could no longer get that if you do this interpretation. The interesting thing about the court decision is that, as you know historically, it's the legislature who decides what is public, what is private, what is secret, what is not, depending on your point of view. But here, it was the court that decided. The court that took an argument, which I consider is a round peg in a square hole, saying that an individual who you define as natural person can be a corporation for the interpretation of this law. And it's not me who uses the term secret. If you review the dissent of Thiessen, Justice Thiessen, He uses it four or five times. He says, this data, which used to be public for 40 years, is now secret. And one of the things, like I spoke with a member just before the meeting, and it was like on the inactive investigative part of the civil law. One of the things that's so important is, as we all know, and as I know, being around for 50 years, seeing the growth of the Attorney General's office, they're more so intertwined with our lives in so many ways that we need to know more, no matter who is it of the AG. And one of the things that was talked about, it made me think about how the AG is involved in many civil investigatives on environment, on dynamics, whatever. And so let's say the AG was involved to do an investigation about an environment situation in a neighborhood or a community. And the AG decided, hey, we're not going to go forward with it. But the community knows there's a lot of stuff that's happening in the community. And they think, they want to know why the AG did not make that decision, why it made the decision not to go with the civil suit. Well, before 2022, community members, groups could go and find out, hey, I want to take a look at the inactive civil investigative data. Now they would not be able to do so. And so there is the issue of accountability, sunshine. And so I share that aspect. Now, in response to the Attorney General's letter, the Office of the Attorney General gives an impression through the letter that this has been secret for years. The information that they say is not available to the public. I think the public record and the experience, I can go on. That's not the case. The decision made a major change in that office. I want to refer to 1B, which is basically when the Attorney General is saying is subdivision 1B, records of non-final policy and administrative decisions. I just want to say, we don't have a deliberative process privilege recognized in the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. The Attorney General's office argues that. You, over the years, have had deliberative process type language proposed. Everyone, it's all been rejected. One of the things that the mayor, the cities wanted to have all their budget data, I call it secret, but that was rejected. No, because you felt the public deserved to know how decisions were being made. So I just wanted to say, and also, FOIA is not data practices for draft data. Again, as it's been said, they do have existing protections in law, you know, under attorney-client privilege, under 1339.3, with active civil investigations, completely protected. But when it's non-active, it should be treated like any other public attorney, city attorney, county attorney, and even in some of the agencies that do investigations of a civil investigative nature. The other one, if you look in terms of the consumer, most of that data is private. And data on individual complainants were private before EPA and will stay private after HF 20. Now, the thing is, rather than go to court to get a decision, why hasn't the AG historically come to the legislature to get it classified? The other part is the other one is the inactive civil investigative data, which I shared with you about, and it's very clear. That has always been available to the public when the case is closed. And if you look at, and as that was under 1339, but now with the decision, it wipes out 1339 and that they're now using that decision. Those were just the points I drew. There were a couple others, but I think I would close with this. It should not be political. And as you know, I'm around enough to know, and I talk to people and I hear aspects. It should not be. This is not political. This is a good governance. The Supreme Court made a decision that you should have made. And as Madam Chair and lead, and soon will be co-chair, Liebling knows, the Supreme Court made a decision on health records law. Took a stray out of it. Took it out of the venture of the legislature. And they said, Minnesotans don't have any privacy when it comes to health records. What did, on a bipartisan basis, do? They overturned that decision. With this decision, it's very similar to me the same. The court decided that information that had been public for 40 years, which gives for open sunshine, not transparency, which is too amorphous for me, I say sunshine, and accountability to an office, and have, you know, that does a lot of things, the legislature should step in and sort of just say, uh-uh. Whether it takes this form or another form, there has to be some address. And that can be done on a bipartisan basis. And I don't like a round peg in a square hole determining public accountability and sunshine. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments that you've allowed me to make comment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. We have one person on the list so far, Representative Feist. Go ahead with your question, and then I'd like to hear from the Attorney General's office since they're in the room. Go ahead.
Well, thank you so much. I have just a really ticky-tacky question about how this would work now that we've talked like high level, and then I just have a broader question. So I submitted an inquiry to the AG's office because AT&T kept charging me $4 a month for literal ever, and no matter how many times I told them I don't have an account with you, they kept charging me $4 a month. So finally I went to the AG's office just through their consumer complaint division, and they looked into it. They reached out to AT&T. AT&T said, my bad, and stopped charging me $4 a month, and then they closed it. So I just want to understand at what point all of this, like what's public, what's not. So my information under existing law would never be public. Like, if somebody did a data practices request, they wouldn't be like, Sandra, I had an account with AT&T, and this is her address. So so when would AT&T, like, so under the court interpretation, the AT&T inquiry would never be public? And is your proposal that it that we should always have known that I submitted an inquiry against AT&T even before it was resolved? And that is my question.
Right. So my understanding is that you're a natural person. That means you would be an individual, and that so this bill wouldn't change the application of the law to you at all. It would only change the application about data that isn't about an individual, which is defined in the Data Practices Act as a natural person.
Thank you. Thank you. And so when would AT&T be public? Like if somebody did a data practices request, at what point would we know that I submitted a complaint against AT&T?
Majority
under
Leader
your proposal.
Oh, sorry. Majority Leader Niska.
Sure. So I think it would become public to AT&T, or it would become known potentially to AT&T if the Attorney General's office took some enforcement action against AT&T, and that had to be disclosed to them. And that would, I mean, this law wouldn't change the application of that principle. You know, when an Attorney General's office goes forward with any sort of investigative action, there's going to be potentially disclosure about the evidence that underlies that in that process. There might be a protective order or something to protect you, but none of the this change wouldn't have any effect at all on the application of any of that scheme as it relates to data about you as an individual, because you're a natural person. It would only have any effect about data that doesn't implicate some natural person, and where there's not the privacy interest that the Data Practices Act is trying to protect about natural people, and that I mean that's the definition of individual in the Data Practices Act.
Representative Feist.
Thank you. So if it turned out that I did have an account with AT&T and I just didn't want to pay them $4 a month, and the AG's and the AG closed it and AT&T did nothing wrong, would it still be public that I submitted this inquiry?
Representative Niska.
That might be a better question for Mr. Gemmerling, but I believe the answer is that would never be public to anyone other than you as the individual subject of the data. You would be able to still, because it's a data on individuals, there you have, as the individual involved, you have the ability to get it. But because it's because it does involve you as a natural person, it falls into this very protective category of data on individuals. The problem that this bill is trying to correct is that there is a whole bunch of data that doesn't implicate a natural person like you, but that's being shielded from view as if there is a natural person whose privacy interests are implicated, and it's taking all of that information out of public view. So when we're talking about nonprofits or corporations or other entities that are trying to influence the Attorney General's office, either or whether we're talking about investigations into fraud that never turn into a final investigative thing, and it's just an investigation of a company or a nonprofit or something like that. The problem that this bill is trying to correct is that kind of data, even when no individual person's privacy interests are implicated, gets treated as if there is a natural person who has a privacy interest that's implicated. And the end result of that is that we lose sunlight, we lose accountability into our Attorney General's office. And like Mr. Gemmerling said, the Attorney General's office ends up being treated in sort of this special secret way compared to every other government agency, compared to any other prosecutor's office, compared to the governor's office. And that really distorts the way that the Data Practices Act works, specifically as it relates to investigations or policy decisions by the Attorney General's office that don't actually implicate the privacy interests of any individual person.
Representative Feist?
Thank you so much. Thank you for that answer. And just my broader question, I feel like there's a really interesting question of statutory construction here and interesting policy considerations, and I feel like there is some middle ground and some ways to draft this to achieve your goal and maybe avoid some of the unintended consequences that the Attorney General's office is worried about. And I know that you presented this to the Commission on Data Practices a year ago, and I'm just wondering what conversations you've had with the AG's office about maybe trying to, like, tease apart the policy considerations and make this a little bit more complicated.
Majority Leader Niska.
Thank you. So I had a conversation with the Attorney General on January 17th. It was a more general conversation about the Attorney General's office's budget, the challenges that might come in, that in the funding requests that they're asking for, and the need to, you know, continue the important work that the Attorney General's office does. We did briefly discuss this bill, but nothing that resulted in any suggestions. I would, I have looked at their letter that they submitted before, they submitted here in the I would suggest that the concerns that they have raised really implicate other parts of the Data Practices Act that might be amended. So, for example, the attorney provision, if there is insufficient protection there, that might be a place where they might suggest amendments. If there's concerns about whether individual should only cover natural persons or whether it should cover, like, family farms, that might be a broader discussion for this committee, because it would affect more than just this provision of the Data Practices Act, right? If we're concerned about a family farm being treated not like an individual person, like we think that a family farm, first of all, I think I appreciate the openness to considering the personal, the personhood of other entities other than natural persons. I think that is an interesting topic of conversation, but if we want to look at that problem more comprehensively in the Data Practices Act, that might be, it might be worth talking about the definition of individual and whether it should be broadened beyond just natural persons. I would also point out that there is in 13.65 a specific provision about confidential data. Subdivision 2 defines certain data as confidential, and if the Attorney General's office needs that definition broadened, to cover things that wouldn't be data on individuals, that would be, I think, an interesting question for this committee to consider. But as it relates to Subdivision 1, when we're talking about things falling into the bucket in the overall scheme of private data on individuals, I think Justice Thiessen is right, both as a matter of statutory construction and as a matter of policy, that the items on that list should be only considered private data on individuals when it's actually a natural person as an individual implicated. That's the only way the scheme makes sense and doesn't create the distortions that we've talked about here.
Representative Feist, you're good? All right. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Niska. So I had a comment, and then I do have a couple questions for the AG's office, and I don't know if they're here. I'm seeing some head nods. So I'll start with my comment. I know one of the testifiers said the Minnesota Supreme Court was doing the work of the legislature, and I just want to make clear that it is the Minnesota Supreme Court's job to interpret the statutes, just like the Minnesota Supreme Court interprets our Constitution. But if there is an issue with that interpretation, like I understand you have, and that's why you brought your bill, that is the job of the legislature to look into that. So I just wanted to make it very clear that that is the Minnesota Supreme Court was doing its job. People may not like the answer, but it was doing its job. My question for the Attorney General's office relates to the data under the Data Practices Act that you do comply with. I worked in the AG's office for 13 years, and I am keenly aware that that office gets many data practices requests and does have to comply with Chapter 13. And so I just want to hear from them about their compliance with Chapter 13 in general. And then also what happens if you do something that you're disclosing information that's protected by Chapter 13. I know there's some suggestions made that this Supreme Court decision has changed the way the Attorney General has done business, but there is a penalty for that if the Attorney General's office starts disclosing information inappropriately. And so I just want to know what that sort of penalty is if they were to do that.
If we could have the person from the AG's office come forward, that would be great. Thank you for being here. Please state your name for the record, and Representative Mueller, if you want to answer Representative Mueller's question, that'd be great.
Good morning. My name is Oliver Larson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the AG's office. I've been with the office since 2012, and I am the attorney who was primarily litigated the EPA versus Ellison decision. So I think there were probably a couple of questions, Representative Mueller. Maybe you could repeat them for me, and I can take them one by one.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, there was a suggestion made, really, that the AG has more protections than any other agency when it comes to data practices. And as somebody who has worked in that office, I know that you do get many data practices requests, and you comply with those requests. I haven't been in that office in a long time. But I'm just curious what some of the Chapter 13 provisions are that your office, gets complaints about or ring queries about, not necessarily complaints, but requests for data under.
Mr. Larson. Sorry, we get a broad array of data practices requests. And in terms of what kinds of protection are afforded to our office, I will note that our office has less protection than the courts and less protection than everybody in this room.
Mr. Larson, let me stop you right there. There's a reason that the legislature is not subject to the Data Practices Act. We deal with constituents all the time. So that's an age-old argument, but if you could just stick to Representative Mueller's question, that'd be great. Thank you.
Well, I mean, the question was, what kind of protections are afforded to our office in comparison to other arms of state government? I'm not here to tell you that the legislature should be subject to the DPA, but what I will say is that you are correct that one of the concerns that animates the legislature not being subject to the DPA is that they hear from constituents, and there is a need and a desire to protect those communications. Our office also hears from constituents. And so I think that animates some of the same. I think what's going on in 1365 is a recognition that our office does hear from constituents about concerns that they have in their lives, and that some protection should be afforded to that, because if it is not, those people will be reluctant to come to us. So
They are protected, though. They are protected. It's private data on individuals.
Well,
they're covered. In Representative Feist's example, her information that she contacted your office would not be made public because it's personally identifiable information.
That is not clear under this amendment. So Let me say a couple of things. I mean, one of the things I think has been presented to this committee is this idea that you can just look at data and know whether it's about an individual or not about an individual. And it's not that easy. If you go back and read the Supreme Court decision in the EPA versus Ellison, they grapple with this exact issue. So, for example, Representative Feist, when you submit a complaint about AT&T, there's a question. Is the data about you or is the data about AT&T? And so that, and it can be both, right? And so under this provision, it is not clear that we would still be able to protect the identity of complaining witnesses. And that's one of the things that we have highlighted, that if individuals contact us and the data is considered to be about the party who's complained about and not about the complaining party, then that data would have to be turned over. The other issue I would point out, and we have talked about family farms or any small business that's organized in LLC, we would have a situation in which, you know, if Representative Feist runs like a small bakery, and so in the name of her bakery, she submits a complaint to our office saying AT&T is charging my small business things it shouldn't be charging. Under this amendment, no protection would be afforded. There would be no argument that it's about an individual, even though effectively the difference between her running her business in her own name or her running her business as an LLC is probably not material and it's not really what the statute's trying to drive at. And I will say, for example, the family farming example is particularly acute. I mean, I dealt with a situation this fall in which we had Pure Prairie, a large poultry producer that went bankrupt, and we had to deal with the fallout of that. And what I will say is that if you are a small farmer in the poultry industry, you basically are beholden to the companies that buy your product. And it is very scary for those small farmers to contact our office and lodge complaints against some of these entities, because they know if their counterparty finds out that they're the complaining party and they terminate the contract, the farmer will go bankrupt. So there is a need to strike a balance to make sure that people who have concerns about any so they're dealing with feel comfortable coming to our office and making complaints. And so, you know, this change, I think, is kind of a sledgehammer trying to deal with a much more nuanced problem. And that if we want to deal with it, I think that there's better ways than just flipping this one term, because there are going to be a lot of unintended consequences to that.
So my question then would be, why has this not been an issue in the last 40 years?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
You've been operating under the, as Justice Thiessen says, I find it hard to understand how data can be private data on individuals when it is not data on individuals. You've been parsing this out for 40 years. So what all of a sudden with this EPA case made some flick, talk about some switch go off to say, oh, no, this is an individual, when that's never been the definition before.
One thing I will point out is that the data requests and the decisions that led to the EPA case were not actually made under the Ellison administration. These were decisions that were made under the Swanson administration. And I just point that out, that this narrative that somehow there's been a change in the practice is not accurate. I've been at the office since 2012. I will say that in the time I've been at the office's interpretation on this issue of how to apply the first line of Subdivision 1 has remained consistent. And at least people I talk to, that has been accurate as well. So I don't think there's been any kind of sea change in how we've been operating in my time there in terms of how we interpret these provisions. What I will say is, and again, the Supreme Court decision gets into this, when you have mixed kinds of data, the utility of 1365 right now is that we get in a request and that we may have a lot of data that if we had to parse it, it would be very difficult to parse. Like, is it data about the individual? Is it data about somebody else? Is it data about an entity? And what we're able to do is look at it and say, okay, is the entity that's requesting it, if it's an entity, then we can look at the statute and say, well, because it's classified as private data on individuals, we know that they wouldn't have access to it. And so we don't need to engage in that kind of level of detail analysis on how we classify the data individual versus entity. And the Supreme Court talks about that as being one of the reasons that this interpretation of 1365 actually makes sense, because how it allows us to approach data practice requests that come in.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a second part to my question, and that was if there is a violation of the Data Practices Act, I understand there is a remedy in statute, so the AG has the added responsibility, as would any entity that's subject to data practices, to make sure they're not disclosing too much information because there could be a problem on that end. So could you just please explain what that is?
And we do face, not just us, but state agencies in particular, face lawsuits on both sides, right? There are situations in which an agency or office classifies the data as being not accessible to the person requesting it, and we get lawsuits from a person who wants to challenge that, and there's a robust process for that. And at the same time, there are situations in which, you know, whether it's our office or an agency releases data and the person, it's about a person or entity, and they claim that it's, you know, subject to protection and should not have been released, and we face claims for that as well.
Representative Miller? Good. Okay. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Niska, for bringing this bill forward. I'm in full support of it. I see a letter here, pretty funny, actually, in opposition to this bill from the Attorney General's office, which cites family farms. I heard small bakeries that was invoked, but I'm kind of digging into potentially what larger entities may exist that the Attorney General's office is actually trying to shield us from. In 2022, we see an NPR interview that may shed light on that. So let's start from the top here. They ask, what about the issue that your office employs at least one lawyer, but maybe two, that is being funded by a nonprofit with money from the Michael Bloomberg Family Foundation? The Attorney General's response, I don't dig into where the donors are, so I'm hearing about all of this from third-party sources. But according to the critics, the foundation that Michael Bloomberg started, which is governed under the laws of the state of New York, which has an independent board that makes decisions, is a professional charitable foundation donated to New York University, and then New York University set up the program. So this is potentially millions of dollars that are flowing into the AG's office to influence the decisions that the office makes that is really being shielded right now under the current interpretation of the law.
So
Representative Niska, would this make publicly available data that would show Minnesotans who's actually funding the work that the AG's office is conducting in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Engen, for that question. This does, yes, create some additional transparency into all of that kind of stuff. Who is influencing the Attorney General's office and what to what end? And I think it's important that as we listen to the examples given by the Attorney General's office, understand that the problems that they're pointing to, the problems with interpretation of the Data Practices Act, what is an individual, what is not, that's a problem across the board with it to every agency that deals with the Data Practices Act. They all are subject to the potential liability of violating that. Whether an LLC is a person's alter ego or a family farm, that should be protected. That's an interpretive issue that the legislature has to decide as it relates to the entire Data Practices Act. And it seems like the Attorney General's office is trying to sort of use those as special pleading for itself to be protected where other state agencies or other agencies wouldn't be. And it does implicate a lot of those kind of concerns. It could be concerns from the other side of the aisle as well if the Attorney General's office was held by someone of a different political party. So it's important sunshine on the Attorney General's office. It's not a partisan issue.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Niska, I actually appreciate you bringing the bill. You know, I believe in transparency. That's why I've supported transparency around corporations, informing folks of how they have foreigners investing in their in the work that they do. So I do believe in shining lights on things, and I do believe in the transparency piece. The only question I have is, did you request a fiscal note for this bill?
Representative Niska?
I did not.
Okay.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see this, if we were to pass this into law, and now the AG's office would be required to be more be responsive to these particular requests, I would imagine that would be some type of cost. And so I'm just wondering if you plan to request a fiscal note.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Frazier. I'm not planning to request a fiscal note. It's not increasing the number of requests that the AG would have to, AG's office would have to sort through. I did, this was one of the issues that I did speak with the Attorney General about in that meeting that I was referencing, and he did bring up the concern about their need to respond to them. I don't think this bill actually changes that effect, but I am sympathetic to that concern. I have talked to Chair Nash about potentially the Attorney General's office getting another FTE or something like that to help deal with that concern. That's a concern that I think is independent of whether this bill goes forward or not, but I am sympathetic to that concern from the Attorney General's office.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the reason I ask, obviously, we're in a budget year. So anything that I see come across, and it appears that it's going to cause some type of cost, I want to make sure that we're adequately taking a look at that so that we can make decisions based on what that cost is going to be. And then the other question I had is this, the AG's office is under State Gov. Is this bill, are you planning to take this bill to State Gov as well?
Representative Niska.
Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, the motion is to send it to the General Register. I did talk to Chair Nash about it, and he doesn't need to see it in his committee.
Representative Frazier?
But I don't understand how we would skip that process. One, I think we need a fiscal note. It would give us time to get that fiscal note. And two, it's overseen by, that office is overseen by State Gov, and Rep. Nash is saying he has no interest in overseeing something that is seen by, that his committee oversees.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you, Representative Frazier. As I said, this is really just changing two words in the Data Practices Act that this committee has jurisdiction over. Certainly, like I said, I'm sympathetic to the concern of the Attorney General's office about whether they currently have the resources to deal with data practices requests that they currently get. And I think it, like I said, I've talked to Chair Nash about that being potentially an issue or a feature in the budget conversations around the state, around the Attorney General's office. This particular bill doesn't increase or decrease the requests that are given. It just decreases the ability for the Attorney General's office to hide information that would be in the requests that are already potentially out there, whether or not this bill goes on.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, as people probably know, I'm not a lawyer, so I just wanted to ask, I'm very interested in the individual, non-individual division, and I know we've talked about the family farms, and I'm not going to, you know, make us go through a list of every kind of potential individual and non-individual, but I do think it's important for people to know, like, is a single proprietor LLC that was started by a person who is side gigging, like, is that a non-individual? And the data regarding that person's maybe passion project that they do on the side of their day job, is that information protected or not protected?
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Finke. That's an interesting question. I think that's an open legal question in Minnesota. I'm not sure that there's any direct on-point case law about what the interpreting, and again, we're talking about, that would be about the definition of individual in a different section of the Data Practices Act, and it would apply to every agency, every, you know, classification of private data on individuals. I think probably that person has a pretty good argument that they're, that business is their alter ego, that the data about that business is really data about them as an individual. That probably is an interesting potential bill for this committee to consider as to whether or not to clarify that individual definition, just like it would potentially be an interesting, I think, bill for this committee to consider whether to amend individual to include. We do have other provisions that define family farms and talk about them having rights more like a person or a natural person than like just a business under our law. But maybe nonpartisan research has more information about that. I don't think that that's a settled question in Minnesota law.
So just so members know, we have a presentation and we need to start in about 6 minutes for that presentation. Representative Finke.
Okay, thank you. I will try to be quick. I think that personally, you'll never hear me defending the idea that large corporations should have their data kept private, right? I think I understand the intention of what's being done here. I think I understand the way that attorney general's offices from either political, you know, bent could make. There are serious concerns, regardless of who's in that office. I think that that's possible, but I do have a. I find it troubling to consider it sort of like a special pleading of the attorney general's office to avoid responsibility by going in and saying these actual individual people need to be protected and we need to know before we make this change whether or not that's going to open a potential floodgate on people. Huge numbers of people have LLCs, started a little nonprofit just because they're interested in something. They're landlords. You know, any number of people engage in business in any number of ways. And I also think that we are seeing a sort of changing, like I think there is a potential downstream effect in which, you know, hypothetically a certain demographic of Americans might be facing a national campaign of public erasure led by the federal administration that would then say, oh, are these people, let's go after business owners that fit that demographic because we believe they should not be part of our public discourse. Let's go after their nonprofits. Let's go after their small businesses. If all of those people are suddenly having their private data, which is essentially their passion, if their life is their passion, it's space that they're operating in, those people will be, this will be weaponized. I really do, that makes me very nervous. So I believe that what we want to do, I think I can get there, which is these corporations should not have their privacy protected. I don't give two things about the privacy rights of major corporations. But we have to know beforehand whether or not those businesses are going to be able to survive. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kinkey. We have Representative Curran and Representative Liebling, and we have about 4 minutes left. And we do have a room tonight, room, what is it? 123, if we need to come back. So Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Just wanted to circle back. Representative Engen had a question, and it sounded like the AG's office might have also had a response, and I would love to hear that if we could give them that chance.
Mr. Larson.
Yeah, I just want to note that the genesis of the EPA suit was this desire to get documentation about the relationship between the office and NYU. That document has been made publicly available. The reason it wasn't made publicly available in response to the request that led to the EPA Ellison decision is because it didn't exist yet. So our office did not enter into these fellowship agreements until later in 2019. These two data requests that generated this lawsuit came in 2018. And so when we got the data request in, there just wasn't any data. And that's what we told them. Later on, after we had entered into these agreements, we got basically the same data request from the same entity in 2019, and we produced the data. Nobody's hiding the contracts that exist between our office in NYU. Nobody's hiding the financial relationships that are there. The reason that the data wasn't produced in 2018 is because it didn't exist.
Representative Curran?
That's all. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if members want to come back this evening. I do think this is a really important discussion that shouldn't be cut off. Maybe we've exhausted it for now, but we did have quite a few testifiers in the beginning who did take up a substantial amount of the time. I'm glad that the issue about the costs was raised. I think that's a serious issue, one that needs to be examined in the proper way that we do that. We do have procedures for that. We refer bills to the committees where fiscal notes are requested and they get looked at in committees, and that's usually how we do that, not by kind of private offline conversations and, you know, talking to the chair and that's it. We do it in a way that's transparent, which is you get a fiscal note that we can all read and look at. You know, when I finish my comment here, which is going to be pretty brief, I'm going to make a motion that we re-refer the bill to state government because I do think it needs to go there and I think it needs to get a fiscal note. But I just want to raise the issue that, well, I do think that there is some work that needs to be done here, Representative Niska. I appreciate the issue being raised. I think it's a really, and I'm pretty new to this area. I haven't worked with data practices for a long time, and so I'm a bit coming into it as a newcomer. And I do think there are issues here. I do think there are work needs to be done on these statutes to clarify a lot of things. I don't think your bill gets us there. I think that there is are just too many questions outstanding. I also think that there's a deep irony right now as we talk about privacy, as we talk about transparency in government. I think we here think transparency in government is a really important thing. At the same time, we have on the federal level, the Trump administration is taking a wrecking ball to transparency in government. He has fired inspectors general across the federal government. They are tasked with uncovering wrongdoing and helping the public to know what's going on, and he has summarily fired them illegally. He also has the so-called DOGE going on, which is taking a wrecking ball to payment systems across the federal government and doing it with an unelected, unaccountable leadership that has no accountability to anyone. And so here we are, you know, talking about how we want to protect transparency in government, which we here, I think, is, we here believe is important. I think we bipartisanly believe that's important. But I just want to call that out because, you know, what we're talking about here is, you know, a flea on an elephant when it comes to transparency. But, Madam Chair, I do want to make a motion to refer this bill to state government because I think that is really where it ought to go. And I, you know, Representative Niska, I think if you were to go forward with this as is, I think I can be pretty confident that it would be very difficult to get 68 votes for it as it is right now. But I think with some work, with some bipartisan work, and some of the members on this committee, I think, are very interested in working on the bill. And working with the AG's office, I think we might actually get to something that everybody could be a little more happy with. So I would really encourage you to support my motion, send it to state government. Let's continue the discussion, and maybe we can get to something that actually improves transparency without taking a wrecking ball to our privacy. Thank you.
Representative Niska, before we take the vote, any comments?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for those comments. I do appreciate the effort to use the broader Trump distraction or deflection strategy to apply to this bill, which has nothing to do with the Trump administration or federal government. It only has to do with our ability, our right as Minnesotans to know what's happening in Minnesota in this important state government office. I would note, I certainly would hope that at least one Democrat in the House would agree with Justice Thiessen about what he thinks the proper interpretation or proper understanding or organization of the Minnesota Data Practices Act is. If that's not the case, I guess so be it. But I think Justice Thiessen was right, completely right. He didn't need a fiscal note in order to say what he thought the Data Practices Act does or should mean. I don't think that this committee or this body needs a fiscal note either. The Data Practices Act exists. When it was implemented, perhaps a fiscal note was needed, but this just changes what is private and what is not private under that Data Practices Act. It doesn't create any additional costs. I do have sympathy for the Attorney General's office's concerns more generally in existing concerns about the Data Practices Act, and we certainly, that could be a good conversation in the state government committee, but this particular bill, adding two words to the Data Practices Act, does not create the kind of cost that would justify derailing this and preventing it from moving forward.
So we're going to go ahead with a vote here.
And, Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call on that vote.
Okay, a roll call has been requested. Representative Liebling has moved that House File 20 be re-referred to the State Government Committee. The CLA will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
No.
Vice Chair Hudson?
No.
Representative Bliss?
No.
Representative Curran.
Yes.
Representative Duran.
No.
Representative Ingen.
Nope.
Representative Feist.
Yes.
Representative Finke.
Yes.
Representative Frazier.
Yes.
Representative Mahmoud.
Yes.
Representative Moeller.
Yes.
Representative Rarick.
No.
Representative Steer.
No.
So the vote is 6-7 in favor of the nays. The motion does not prevail. Representative Niska, any final comments on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the conversation. It is like Justice Thiessen said, this is the way to put the Data Practices Act back into the balance, into the rational scheme that was intended. But more importantly than that, it's creating very, very important transparency that Minnesotans can have sunlight, sunshine into the very important work that is happening in the Attorney General's office, that we can hold whoever is in that chair accountable for the decisions that they make or don't make, and we can know who's influencing or who isn't influencing the actions of that office. So I think it's a very important bill that we move forward today, and I appreciate support.
Representative Lealy? Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call.
Okay, a roll call has been requested. I will renew my motion that House File 20 be re-referred to the General Register. The CLA will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hudson?
Aye.
Representative Bliss?
Aye.
Representative Curran?
No.
Representative Duran?
Aye.
Representative Ingen?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Finke?
No.
Representative Frazier?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Moeller?
No.
Representative Rarick?
Aye.
Representative Steer?
Aye.
The ayes being 7 and the nays being 6, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Niska, for being here and presenting your bill. Next up, we have folks from the Office of Data Practices. And please come to the testifiers table and introduce yourselves. And we look forward to your presentation.
Please go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Taya Moxie-Goldsmith. I'm the Director of the Data Practices Office at the Minnesota Department of Administration. Thank you for inviting me here today to talk about data practices. Obviously, you had a robust conversation about data practices already, so we're going to take a step back and just talk about the basics for those of you who have been on the committee for a while. This will be familiar to you. For those of you who are newer, this might be a newer area, an introduction to this particular law. Why are we talking about this? As discussed already, the legislature determines who can access government information by classifying government data and permitting or requiring sharing. And I like to highlight and amplify, I think, what Chair Scott has probably already said to you about this area. This committee plays a vital role in the House in looking at these issues and discussing, as you just have, the policy considerations around data practices. And hopefully you can all also serve as a resource to your colleagues outside of this committee who probably don't think about this law very much and don't know much about it. The Data Practices Act is in Chapter 13 of Minnesota statutes, and it regulates how government handles information. Again, as you were just discussing, it tries to maintain a proper balance of the public's right to know about the activities of their government, so those transparency and accountability pieces, the privacy rights of individuals, because we have a privacy interest in our own information, and then the government's need to have and use data to do its own work, so that's the government efficiency piece. As you can see and as you know, sometimes these rights or these policy interests can be competing, and it really is up to you to determine which one of these kind of comes out on top in a given circumstance or situation. We start from the basis that all government data are public unless they are classified as not public by either a state law or federal law. The Data Practices Act also classifies data as not public. It's about 200 pages long, so there are a lot of not public classifications in Chapter 13. There are also a ton outside of Chapter 13. It provides access rights for the public and data subjects, and those rights are slightly different, and I'll point out a couple of those places. And then it requires data on individuals to be accurate, complete, current, and secure. So there are additional requirements, administrative and security requirements, specific to data on individuals. There are two other laws just to be aware of. The Official Records Act is in 1517. It requires government to make and preserve all records necessary to a full and accurate knowledge of official activities. Essentially, government needs to show their work. Right. The Records Management Statute in 138.17 requires that we maintain government records, which are different. They're a subset of government data, according to a records retention schedule. And we're not allowed to destroy those government records before the time limit on that schedule. I'm going to fast forward through these couple just to get to who the Data Practices Act applies to, again, discussed a little bit already today. The Data Practices Act applies to government entities, and those are state agencies, which include the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Colleges and University System as well for purposes of data practices. It includes political subdivisions, which are going to be cities, counties, school districts, soil and water boards, et cetera, local units of government. And then statewide systems, which are record-keeping systems that are common to two or more other government entities. It does not apply to, as noted, the legislature. It's not explicit, but the legislature doesn't fall into any of the definitions of those three other things. The courts are explicitly exempted. The courts have their own rules of public access. It does not apply to most non-metro townships, so non-metro townships do not have to comply with data requests or any of the administrative requirements of this law. And then non-governmental entities. We occasionally will get questions about non-governmental entities. The exception to this is if a private entity is contracted with government and they're performing a government function. Then they are subject to Chapter 13 to the scope of that contract. So what are government data? We've talked about this already. I've said it a lot. This is the definition. All data collected, created, received, maintained, or disseminated by any government entity, regardless of its physical form, storage media, or conditions of use. So obviously, this is a very broad definition and really gets at just any recorded government information. There was a Supreme Court case on mental impressions, and mental impressions are not government data. It does have to be recorded in some format. The reason I believe, you know, this law is 50 years old, and I think at the time in 1974, using the word government data seemed like a good idea. And the idea being that we're not just talking about the four corners of a document, is this paper public or not public? We're actually talking about the individual pieces of information within a certain record or document, and so I believe that is why the phrase was used. To get at the discussion you were just having, there are generally two types of data. Data on individuals is that data that identify a natural person or a living human being. And the reason that I phrase it in that way is because there is actually a definition of the word person as well in the Data Practices Act, which includes individual, but it also includes things like corporations and organizations and businesses. Data not on individuals are data that do not identify somebody, so it's everything else. There's also a provision on data on decedents, so they would fall on the data not on individual side. So data that identify someone, here are some examples of that. Again, data that don't identify someone would be things, companies, websites, and then de-identify data on individuals. So if we can't tell who the data are about, then they're no longer on the left side of this chart. Okay, those two broad categories are then broken down into classifications. This is probably the chart that Mr. Gemmerling was talking about. It's still relevant and useful today, so we use it in all of our trainings as well. for both data on individuals and data not on individuals. Public is the first classification. Again, we presume that government are public. We start from that basis. It's available to anyone for any reason, and in fact, government cannot ask somebody why they want public data. If they want public data, they can have it for any reason or no reason, and we can't ask about it. So an example of that would be a public employee name and salary. Those things are public, and anybody could have them. They can put them up on a website tomorrow. The next set of classifications is private data on individuals and non-public data not on individuals. And these are available to the data subject, that is the person that they are about, those in the entity whose work assignment reasonably requires access, so those who need it to do their job, entities authorized by law, those with statutory authority, and then those authorized by the data subject. So if you have written informed consent, an entity could share this private or non-public data. Examples of that might be an employee's home address or home phone number. So if you're to request my home address and home phone number from my employer, they will say, you can't have that, 1343, it's private data. The next set of classifications is confidential data on individuals and protected non-public data not on individuals. And those are only available to those within the entity whose work assignment requires access and entities authorized by law. So you will note here the public does not get access to these, and even the person that is about does not get access. There is only a very narrow set of confidential and protected non-public data because obviously we have a very strong public policy not to have secret databases about people. And so even their classic examples, active civil legal investigation or active criminal investigative data, those are confidential, protected, non-public for a finite amount of time, but they will eventually either become public or private, non-public, so that someone will be able to access those data eventually. There's just a very narrow category of confidential, protected, non-public that stays that way all the time. And it's important to note that classification drives access. So as you're reviewing bills and provisions that come before you, it's very important to be precise with the language that we're using, exactly the conversation you just had, because we use the word private and confidential to mean the same thing, probably when we're just talking generally. But here they have very specific meanings, and it will decide who's going to be able to access this data going forward. So your role is to consider how government data should be classified and who should get access to it. And as you're thinking about the proposals that come before you, and again, your work in other committees, think about if you're creating a new task force, work group, commission, are you requiring a new study or report? Are you transferring duties between and amongst agencies or entities? What data is needed to do that work? What statutory sharing or classifications are important? Should that be in the enabling legislation? Should that be in the proposal? We occasionally get to the end of session, effective dates roll around, folks realize that work that you've done for policy and to get things passed is sometimes held up a little bit because the data practices provisions are not there. I'm going to go past this. You can make a data request. Every agency or entity has policies that will tell you how to do that, where you should send it. And these policies are required by 13.025. A little note about requesting data in your legislative capacity for that those purposes. You are just members of the public for data practices. So you don't have any additional rights to not public data just because you're legislators, unless you put that in the law. And then in that case, you would. Government will respond in one of three ways. They'll provide access to the data and copies if you want them. They will inform you the data are classified as not public. And again, if they're not public, they have to give you the specific statute or federal law that makes them not public. They will inform you the data do not exist or are not in the format requested. Entities are not required to create data generally to respond to data requests. So if you ask for something they don't have, it's perfectly fine for them to say there are no data responsive.
Ms. Moxley, could I ask you just to put something in here right now? I just want to make on the previous slide that says answer three up here. There's also a set of rules that kind of govern, that's not in statute, but a set of rules that govern how to go about it, making a data request. Some of those things are like make it as specific as possible and so forth. It's like, so where would a member of the public find that set of rules?
Chair Scott, thank you for that question. Each entity has their own access policy, so how they want you to go about asking for data from their own entity. So at admin, we have designees in every division, and you would go to that particular designee to ask for the data. The policies might also tell you about how the entity deals with copy costs or how they will respond if they don't have the data. So the each entity will have their own policy around that. There are also administrative rules that implement this section, which is Chapter 1205 of the of Minnesota rules. Briefly, this is an area where there's a difference between how data subjects and data and members of the public are treated in terms of their rights and responsibilities. Members of the public, when they ask for data, the response time is appropriate and prompt in a reasonable amount of time. That's a really nebulous amount of time, but it really depends on what they ask for. If it's a big, complex ask of 10,000 emails, that's going to take months, probably. If it's a very simple request for meeting minutes, hopefully that would take a matter of days. However, for data subjects, if you're asking for data about yourself, it's immediately or 10 days. So that's a hard and fast number. I think when the law was first enacted, it was 5 days. So 10 is actually more than originally thought about. But that sometimes is a hard deadline to meet. But there is no extension time or flexibility there. Once you're past it, you're past it. Copy costs, this is an area we talk about sometimes and receive questions about because it maybe these provisions in Chapter 13 haven't really kept up with how we do business now in 2025. If somebody just wants to come in and look at government data, it's free, so they can't have any charges for that. If they want government to make a copy for members of the public, we're talking 25 cents up to 100 pages of paper. Anything else is going to be what's called actual cost, which means that they can charge the time it takes to look for the data and then the materials. So for the data subject, on the other hand, it's going to be less because you can't charge the time to search and retrieve. So the charges for data subjects will be less.
Ms. Moxley-Smith, we have a member question. I think on a presentation like this, I think it's okay if members have questions as we proceed. That way we don't have to backtrack the pages. Yep. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question relates to the discussion that we've been having here today regarding the distinction between data on individuals and data that's not on individuals. It's been fascinating to listen to imagined hypotheticals that we actually don't need to imagine because we have this distinction that is implemented through every other state agency and has been for 40 years. So the question that I would ask you is, as state agencies have been responding to these data requests, has there been any difficulty or ambiguity regarding classifying whether or not data is on a person or not on a person?
Ms. Moxley-Smith.
Chair Scott, Representative Hudson, thanks for the question. If someone is the identifiable, if a natural person is the identifiable subject of that data, then it's data on individuals, and that would fall on the sort of left side of that chart that I had. I think the interpretive question comes, for instance, my name is on this PowerPoint, but it's not about me, right? This is a PowerPoint about data practices. It's government data. It's public. Anybody can have it for any reason, but it's not personnel data about me. If I email my supervisor and say I need to take a sick day, that's going to be about me and my employment, and that's going to be private on me. So there is a question occasionally about whether something's data on individuals or not, but it is contextual. You have to look at the context. And then whether there's a statute or not, what does the statute say, and what does the distinction mean? But in terms of that case and what is private, private applies to data on individuals in every other context.
You're good? All right.
The remedies for this law are in 13.08. There are actually three civil remedies. There's an action to compel compliance, there's an action for damages, and there's injunctive relief. The legislature has really put enforcement of this law in the courts, and that has been a challenge for some data subjects. I would say we talk about enforcement with data subjects and data requesters all the time. There's an administrative remedy at the Office of Administrative Hearings. It's an action to compel compliance. There are actually criminal penalties. It's a misdemeanor if there's a willful violation or if an employee causes a breach. These don't come up too much, but actually in the last 4 months we have heard of two, but more likely for an employee dismissal or suspension if they're not following this law appropriately. The Commissioner of Administration has permissive authority to issue non-binding advisory opinions. They are exactly that. They are opinions to give advice and explain a situation, but they are non-binding. An entity does not have to follow them.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question about the penalties. And I thought there was a section too. If there was a violation, then there had to be notice given as well, if there was some sort of breach.
Is that correct? And if you could explain that, please.
Ms. Moxley-Goldsmith.
Scott, Representative Moeller, thank you for the question. Yes, in a different section, section 13.055 is the data breach provision, and it applies only to private data or confidential data on individuals. If there is a breach, then there has to be an investigation and notice to the data subjects, and then you know, there would probably be a personnel investigation as well, and some of these other things might occur. I was just going to wrap up here and let you know that, you know, we are here to answer any questions you have. So if you have questions, stay happy to answer them. I know we're running out of time. But my office exists to answer these questions and have these conversations with you. We field about 2,000 questions from members of the public and government each year. We help the commissioner with her duties. And generally, because we help the public and we help government, we do our very best to stay in the middle, which means we really leave those policy decisions up to you to decide where classification should be, where statutory sharing should exist. But we're happy to have discussions around drafting, around clarity. I like to say that we're for clarity. So whatever is clear, that's what we're for. And we're happy to have those discussions with you. So please reach out if you do have questions. These are all the ways that you can contact my office. We're happy to have those discussions.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I just want to add a couple of things. I believe on your website, I know that you offer or you write advisory opinions, and so there's a history of advisory opinions there since I don't know how far it goes back, but probably, yeah, and so that's a good reference for members of this committee and for the public, and you'll only do advisory opinions if there hasn't been something on the same order of business, so to speak, that hasn't been done before, right? So you're not going to redo an opinion that's really kind of already been addressed as by the subject matter. Is that right?
Chair Scott, thank you. Yes, it depends on the circumstances.
Right.
They're very fact-specific, and so there might be a reason why we might revisit something or clarify. So we certainly might answer it again. It depends on the question.
Right. And I know some folks have asked for an opinion, and then you'll say, well, we really only had go to this opinion here. This really explains your issue. And I also wanted to bring up the administrative remedy and going to the Office of Administrative Hearings. It is $1,000 for an individual, a member of the public, or for anybody to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings to get justice when they feel like, an agency or some level of government hasn't been forthright or whatever. So it is really, it's a barrier for a lot of people, and that's always kind of bothered me. But I just wanted to let the members of the committee know that it is kind of expensive to go do that, and not everybody can afford to do that. So, again, thank you for your presentation. Any other member comments or questions? Thank you so much. With that, we are adjourned.